This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's Friday, so let's take a look back at this week, beginning with problems at the Department of Children and Families and the murder of 2-year-old Bella Bond.
This week, the State Office of the Child Advocate issued a scathing report saying DCF failed to investigate warnings of neglect, including her mother's struggles with the law and substance abuse. Here's Child Advocate Maria Mosaitis.
I think it's very clear that the Department of Children and Family needs to have more clarity around what to do when there are suspicions of or indications of substance abuse and how to factor this information into their decision-making process.
State Senate President Stan Rosenberg says among the challenges that DCF faces, heavy caseloads and too little funding.
This agency, like every other agency in state government, when we get into recessions, the budget gets cut. And that's when the cases go up, the number of cases go up. And so we have to stop cutting and we have to protect DCF's budget.
So let's start there, how to fix DCF. With us to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is Renee Loth. She's a columnist for the Boston Globe and a writer for WBUR's Cognoscenti's Ideas Opinion page. And Renee, always good to have you.
Thank you very much.
Also with us today, Richard Tessay, former state Senate Republican Party leader and former Republican congressional candidate that, and also, I don't know why am I screwing this up today, Richard? You're such a regular with us. Oh my God, it has been a long week. Let me just say, Richard Tessay, a man who needs no further introduction. Thanks for coming in, Richard. So first of all, Richard, let me just start with you. You heard Stan Rosenberg there saying that DCF budget needs to be protected, that funding is an issue. Is this all about money?
I think a lot of it is about money because some of the budget cuts that took place years ago wiped out a lot of the mid-management, which you needed in that agency, closed down the Worcester office. So you had one office for the entire western part of the state, and that obviously led to things. But I have to say, too, a lot of this is common sense. I mean, in this case, you had the mother who, from what I understand, I may be wrong, but I understand she was in and out of prison 12 times. She had 2 kids previously taken from her. You know, there should be just common sense that, you know, when you get a call or you start investigating, you know, flags should, should pop up. And, you know, as a matter of course, I think, the state should come in a situation
right.
like that and not fool around and, you know, have a zero tolerance policy.
Well, so, Renee, let me ask you about that, because the Child Advocates report recommends such things as Richard was talking about, like mandating investigations when parents who've had previous parental rights revoked, or enhancing electronic record-keeping systems to include date stamps to prevent copying and pasting of old reports into new ones. I mean, common sense, as Richard said. I mean, what do you make of those suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way, that it's an indication of just how bad things are at DCF that a special investigation would be needed to make these recommendations. I mean, how obvious is this, that if a parent in a case where a parent has lost custody numerous times and has been in and out of prison and there's indications of drug abuse, that this should trigger an extra level of scrutiny seems too obvious to even comment on. I don't know what the ultimate solutions are going to be at DCF. It's something that we've said before, has been going on for decades. Problems for Republican and Democratic administrations doesn't seem to make a difference. Governor Baker is saying he wants a top-to-bottom review of the agency and reforms in the agency, and I almost feel like it needs to be bottom to top, because to start where the cases are closest to the families, because obviously it seems to me that whatever good intentions and changes at the top happen don't filter down to the, where the rubber hits the road, so to
right.
speak,
well,
where the families really are.
And let's just say in the past, you haven't had everybody on the same page. I think what's important and very significant what's happening right now is everybody is rowing in the same direction. The union, or who represents most of the social workers, working very collaboratively with the governor to make sure that the reforms are put in place, again, where the rubber meets the road, to make sure that they stick and that you can effectuate change.
You know, just one last question to both of you about this, because for other governmental agencies in the past, we have had these, so-called stem to stern reviews. I mean, I was on the transportation beat for a long time. The MBTA has had I don't know how many such reviews. But the question is, you know, do we have the will to actually enact the changes that the reviews highlight? I mean, DCF, one hopes, is the exception to what seems to be the rule, that the changes are slow in coming.
Well, that's why it's so significant to have the union working side by side with the administration to make sure that the reforms stick.
Yeah. These are much more complex cases than transportation policy. I mean, these are human stories. They are, you know, multiple problems in these families, financial and social and psychological, and there's violence. I mean, it's a, you know, very complex human endeavor. And so I think it's more difficult to to effectuate change in these agencies than there are in almost any other part of the state government.
All right. Well, let's move on a little bit and talk about the history of the clergy sex abuse scandal in Boston and the release of the new movie that tells the story of how the Boston Globe broke that story open back in 2002. This week's Spotlight had a red carpet opening in Boston. Last night, some of the survivors of the abuse attended a private screening. So here's David Clossie. He's the national director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, who spoke to WBUR's Simone Rios.
The movie is an extraordinary validation to people, literally thousands of men and women who have suffered in silence for decades, that their pain was not in vain and that their courage did not go unrecognized.
Renee, I want to start with you on this one because I know you've seen the film. You wrote about it for Cognoscenti. I have not seen this film. I'm very interested to see it. But give us your reaction to it and the extent to which it does a good job telling the story.
It's a really very wonderful, sober, careful look at, first of all, the sort of grinding essential work that investigative journalists do, just to start. I mean, it's, very true to life, really a respectful and kind of faithful tribute to that kind of work. So that's terrific for, an industry that is having a lot of trouble just even surviving today. And the story it tells about the courage of the victims to come forward and overcome their years of shame and misgivings about speaking to the press, and the careful way that the stories were documented and told, I think is, as the victim we just heard from suggests, a real validation. Mm-hmm. There's a extraordinarily many powerful moments in the film, but for me, at the very end, which I didn't even write about today, after the credits roll, on the screen, they list all of the cities where, because of this investigation in Boston, other sex abuse investigations went on into victims of child sexual abuse at the Catholic Church, and they just list the cities, and there's like 50 per screen, and you just see 50, and then you see another 50, and then you see another 50, and you're just... just overwhelmed by the scope of this thing.
Really something. Richard, I'm not sure if you've seen it, but your reaction to the importance of a film like this.
Well, first, I haven't seen it, and I'm a little disappointed, though, to learn that Renee is not portrayed in the movie at all, because I understand she was the editorial page director at the time. And I do think, a lot of people in my party criticize the Globe, but you really got to give the Globe a lot of kudos for bringing this story out. And initially as a local story, became national and international, and the effect that it's had on people's lives has really been just profound. So I hope to see it soon. And the Boston Globe Spotlight team, in this case, really provided a very valuable public service to everyone.
You know, Renee, to your point about it being a great story of a newspaper investigation, we spoke to Ty Burr recently, and he said it's a great newspaper movie. I think it may be the last great newspaper movie, and it's a great statement. But it saddens me to think that there might not be more great newspaper journalistic investigations that warrant movies about.
There are, as I said today, there are many efforts to try to fill the gaps that we've been losing investigative teams in traditional newspapers, for a decade now. And there are a lot of really good efforts, nonprofits, universities, NPR, that are doing investigations still. But there's really no substitute for the sustained local widely read coverage that a investigation like this can provide.
You know, it's just interesting, and you could actually put this in perspective because, I mean, the resources that the Globe allotted to this investigation, I went over there in the middle of their investigation when they were writing it, and I was shown this room full of research and files and a good number of reporters and editors that were devoted exclusively to it. It is something that you don't see a lot of anymore.
Well, you know, it's a leap of faith on the part of the owners and publishers, editors of a newspaper or any news organization that all of the labor-intensive man and person hours that are devoted to these investigative stories, you know, five full-time staffers working for a year before a single word is written, that kind of thing, that is a huge leap of faith that kind of investment is going to pay off. It doesn't always. And it's a difficult thing to ask, cash-strapped institutions like the Boston Globe or any news organization today to do.
Yeah. Well, let's move on now and talk about the future of student testing in Massachusetts. The state is about to make a decision on whether or not to scrap the MCAS in favor of the PARC test, which is aligned with the new Common Core curriculum. Now, we ran a series about this week on Radio Boston. And as part of that series, we spoke with the man who will put forward the recommendation on MCAS versus PARC versus something else, and that is the Commissioner of Elementary and Secondary Education, Mitchell Chester. And here's what he said about why it's time for a new test.
As strong as MCAS has been and as well as it has served Massachusetts, we gave it last spring for the 18th year in a row. It's stale. It's not up to date. It hasn't raised our aspirations in terms of the kinds of teaching and learning that we expect from our students. So it's time to move on.
Richard, your first thoughts on this?
Well, first, in full disclosure, working for a group that's supporting the PERC test. But I would say that the commissioner is right. I mean, the MCAS was established 18 years ago. It was established just basically to make sure that people had the skills of a 10th grader. Now I think we're going into the 21st century, and we need to make sure that when kids are graduating from school, they have the skills that they need to be successful in a 21st century workforce. And you know, Massachusetts really, no matter which way this comes out, I think it's clear that we need to get on to the next generation of testing and really get up to the next level, and that's what this is all about.
Renee?
Well, I have to say that I'm a little, bemused, disappointed, that this topic, like so many others in our politics today, has devolved into an ideological divide between people on the right who want one of these tests and people on the left who want the other one in general. The Common Core is being, portrayed in some conservative circles as some sort of big government, conspiracy of black helicopters coming down to take our children. And, you know, it's that we shouldn't be having any kind of, federal involvement in education. And then the folks on the other side say, no, MCAS is, not fair to minorities. I mean, it's just turned out to be another crazy and ideological battle when it's really just about, our children's education.
But just about? I mean, that's what, I mean, well, where else does ideology play as powerfully in Massachusetts, nonetheless, over education?
What makes this so interesting, though, is that we are number one. I mean, when the Education Reform Act passed in 1993, it put in place things like the MCAS. There was a lot of opposition to it at the time, but over the years, it's certainly proven that it's worked, high standards, because we've become number one. But we can't, afford to get stale. We have to go to the next level. And here and now, 36% of the kids who are graduating from high school are in need of some type of remedial, course when they get to college. And Sierra Higher for community colleges. So you've got to make sure that kids have the tools that they need to be successful and be able to measure that.
So, what's interesting about this, and Renee, in fact, you kind of inadvertently touched on it, because one would think that this is a left versus right battle when you sort of look at it writ large. But it's really playing out in an interesting way in Massachusetts. Some of the most vocal proponents for MCAS come from the Pioneer Institute, right? Not exactly a left group here in Massachusetts.
It's the conservatives who are for the MCAS and the liberals who are for the PARC.
Right. Well, so let's play a little bit of tape from a representative of the Pioneer Institute, because we talked to Sandra Stotsky. She's a former senior associate commissioner at the Department of Education and a very strong MCAS supporter. Here's what she said.
We looked at the practice test items for PARC and indeed do not see that it in any way develops critical thinking. It does not elicit the kind of writing that would prepare students for college, and its reading test items violate what we know reading research for 100 years has told us.
So, Renee, just the last question on this issue to you. I mean, what is so complicated? There's money, there's ideology, there's curriculum, there's Common Core, there's the federal government, but then there's also just the do we have too much testing question writ large.
And, you know, just to say a couple of very brief good things about the MCAS. I mean, I think it's important for us not to dumb down the tests. If we're going to have them, we do want to maintain the highest standards in the country. There is a legitimate concern, I think, that the Common Core will be kind of a lowest common denominator, and we want to avoid that. But yeah, I think overall we're doing too much testing. You know, I come from a state, I grew up in New York, where we had the Regents high stakes test at the end of every year in every subject in high school anyway. But I never felt that we were teaching to the test. And I do think that every teacher I speak with, says that there's just too much of that at every grade, especially in the lower grades.
Go ahead, Richard.
It's probably important to note, though, not only did we implement the test in 1993, but we poured in billions of dollars in additional education funding.
Right. It wasn't just MCAS.
And I have to say this. I think when you're dealing with the Baker administration, Jim Pizer, and the commissioner, you know, this is a very data-driven administration right now. And I don't think Charlie, I don't think any of them really care whether it's a Democratic or Republican thing. They want to do the very best for the kids in Massachusetts. And I think that's what everybody wants to do here. And, you know, hopefully we'll continue to be a leader and continue to be number one in education throughout this process.
Well, let's move on, because I want to spend a couple of minutes talking again about the Globe Spotlight team, not the movie, but their most recent investigation. Last Sunday, the Globe ran a story about the practice of scheduling overlapping surgeries at Mass General Hospital, told the story of Tony Meng, really disturbing story. He was left paralyzed after a delicate and risky surgical operation on his neck. The surgeon who performed the operation, there are no suggestions that he did anything wrong, but he was working on another overlapping operation just down the hall. So here's Globe reporter Jonathan Saltzman, who worked on the investigation.
We can't say that the overlapping caused the complication, but what we can say first is that these patients say they knew nothing about that, and that patients' rights advocates say that's wrong.
So, again, the report didn't find any evidence that linked concurrent surgeries with complications. But Richard, what about the issue of informed consent? This was a really disturbing story, but I'm not sure what I took away from it.
You know, it's funny. I was at a healthcare symposium today, and I asked a number of healthcare providers what they thought, and it was sort of neutral one way or the other. But I think everybody said the same thing, and that you do need informed consent, and that the patient should know not when you're about to be wheeled into the operating room, but well in advance that you know you're going to be having a procedure where the doctor is double booked, you know, that day. And I wouldn't feel comfortable with it, you know, and I think it would be up to each individual to, you know, to have that information to make their own decision.
Well, Renee, before I go to you, let's listen to David Hoyt. He's the executive director of the American College of Surgeons, which reviewed and approved the practice of overlapping surgeries at MGH. Here's what he told us.
Today, much of surgery is team-based, and what part of a operation a particular individual has may be very relatively focused over time. And as a result, they may be able to then perform an additional operation in another room while somebody else is closing the patient or somebody in another room is opening the patient.
So, Renee, what did you take away from this story?
Well, you know, first of all, it's important that the Globe lifted the veil on this practice, which is apparently widespread, but in some hospitals and not in others, and the patients, by and large, are unaware of it. We need to have the patients fully informed before they go into an operation that's obvious. But, you know, the hospitals say that it does not, you know, place the patients necessarily at a disadvantage and that it's a very small percentage of the operations that are involved. And that may all be true, but the as I understood the story, even at MGH, one of our very best hospitals in the country, the practices are so ill-defined and opaque that it really puts the patients at a disadvantage. I mean, what is a concurrent or overlapping surgery? Is it 3 minutes? overlapping, you know, at the very end, or is it, you know, an hour and a half of the two surgeries going on simultaneously? It's all over the map. And, you know, I think that you don't want the pendulum swinging so far that you sort of jeopardize the whole team teacher, you know, these are teaching hospitals and they do have team operations. You don't want to jeopardize that, but you do want to be able to have some clarity about what we mean when we talk about concurrent surgeries.
Yeah, so I think disclosure is important. And I can be sort of dispassionate about this, but I have to think if when I'm a patient, if I'm a patient lying on the table, it's hard to accept that the whole procedure from prep to closing wouldn't require the attention of the top doc. But, you know, I get where Mass General's coming from on this as well. Well, we should move on because we have just enough time left for our hubbubs, those little stories that might not have made it at the top of the news but caught the attention of our panel. Richard, what's your hub?
Well, I grew up in a household with three sisters, and we were always fighting back and forth who could do things better, boys or girls.
Girls.
13-year-old Ayla Ludlow from Pembroke was watching the Women's World Cup soccer with her brother and apparently had a disagreement. Her brother dismissed the event as something that boys could do better than girls. She did not stand for that. She ended up writing a letter to President Obama, who not only answered the letter, but invited her to the White House, where she was able to read the letter before the president and before the team.
Go Ayla.
Girls World Cup soccer team.
Oh,
so
cool.
I think, at least in that household, this particular issue is settled.
That's right.
Renee, how about you?
Well, I think few people may have noticed this, but Boston on Wednesday experienced what is known as a king tide. It is an astronomically high tide, very rare, 2.5 feet above the normal tide levels. If you go to the New England Aquarium's Twitter feed, you can see a video of the water sloshing over the wall there and flooding the plaza. I would call this a global warning, because we are on track to have these kinds of tides, 2 feet above normal high tide levels, twice a day, every day by 2015, with sea level rise at its current track. And so we have to take this very seriously.
Global warning, indeed. Magna, how about you?
Wow. So given that tomorrow's Halloween, I just could not resist the story that came out of the Government Center T-Stop this week, and that is the discovery. You know, they're doing that $80 million renovation of Government Center. And a construction worker found these very creepy masks. They look sort of like the Scream mask or Phantom of the Opera mask that were buried in concrete that was laid some 60 years ago. And they're attached to these long sort of fabric gowns, or red and blue, and they're spangled. And it was just kind of this very strange, like, why? Who would put them in concrete 60 years ago? Why are they there? What does it portend for the Government Center renovation?
At least there weren't bodies with them.
There were no bodies with them, that's true. But my favorite part of this story is that Joe Pastrue, who's a spokesperson for the MBTA, he said, "We don't really have the resources to launch a full investigation into this." There's the understatement of the year about the tea. "But if the garment's owner comes forward, we'll be all ears." So if anyone out there 60 years later knows why there's creepy masks that were buried under Government Center, let us know.
All right. Well, here's my hubbub. It's a tribute of sorts to Boston's longest-serving mayor, Tom Menino, who died a year ago today. And earlier this afternoon, Boston's current mayor, Marty Walsh, held a moment of silence at City Hall to remember Menino, the urban mechanic. And if you visit our website, radioboston.org, we've posted a picture there from the Boston Globe that shows Menino running for his first mayoral election, 1993. And if you look really closely in the background, there's a young guy in a Red Sox hat that's part of the lining the roadway, and it's a young Marty Walsh, the current mayor. So there it is.
Great. Well, Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a writer for WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Richard, I'm going to make good on how I screwed up your intro at the top of this the segment. Richard Tessay served in the legislature for more than 25 years, including as minority leader in the Massachusetts State Senate.
You got it.
Thanks so much, Richard.
God, I'm glad we got that right. Okay, stay with us. Coming up, we're going to talk with Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano about Paul Ryan's new leadership in the House and what it means. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.